the essence of science is logic, careful collection of data, unwillingness to reach conclusions until you've studied as much evidence as is available. And to check all along the way on the data, what it means, etc. And unfortunately, the scientific community in general has not been scientific in its approach to flying saucers. If you look at the stuff put out by the nasty, noisy negativists, they never reference the large-scale scientific studies. If they talk about interstellar travel, they never reference the studies about that. They don't know anything about nuclear propulsion. Ignorance is bliss, I guess. And people are a little surprised that I am not on the pro-SETI side. And as I said earlier, you know, SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, S-E-T-I. Aren't we after the same thing? No, we're not. I'm after truth. They want to keep their programs going. If alien visitors are coming here, who needs to listen with radio telescopes? Learn sign language might be more productive. So I'm indicting them because I've been following their work. They don't follow mine. You won't find references to the major UFO scientific studies in the work of the SETI people or the astronomical community. And they also are under the strange impression that the only place science gets done is at universities. I hate to disabuse that notion, but, you know, if you want a stealth aircraft, you go to Lockheed. You don't go to some university. I've had two different scientists tell me, Stan, if Roswell had happened, they'd have had to pull the physicists from half the colleges in the country. All I could do was laugh. How absurd. Are they really unaware of places like Los Alamos National Laboratory and Oak Ridge National Laboratory and Sandia and GE and Westinghouse and a whole bunch of other people? All kinds of places where high security and very talented people. As a matter of fact, I checked a few years ago, and the total budget for the three nuclear weapons labs was greater than the total budget of the National Science Foundation on all its projects. All. So it is nonsense to think that only the academics do research. They may talk about a professor and six grad students, or three professors and 20 grad students. When I was working at General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department in Cincinnati, 1956 through 59, in 1958, I checked out the numbers, our budget was $100 million, which was a lot of money in 58. And we employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. That's not a few professors and a bunch of grad students. And we did a lot of research on nuclear airplanes. We never flew a nuclear-powered airplane. We did have a reactor on board an airplane to do radiation shielding tests, and that's another story. But the point is, if you're going to talk about something as controversial and exciting and different as flying saucers, you ought to have a responsibility, if you claim to be a scientist, to do your homework first. That's not an unreasonable demand. So, yeah, I'm ticked off at these guys. So let's push the button and see what happens. You saw about this early, but somebody just wrote a very negative article about me. He's always talking about that old Project Blue Book, Special Report 14, which nobody reads. No, that's the problem. Nobody reads it. It's the largest study ever done for the United States Air Force. It was done by Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. They looked at a total of 3,201 sightings. The report has over 250 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. It's got data that nobody else has published anywhere, but they don't think I should be looking at it, bringing it up. I've checked my audiences, over 700 around the world, and if I'm lucky, I find 1% who've read it. And why do I refer to it? Because it's got answers to the questions you'd like to ask. What fraction of sightings that have been reported to the Air Force could not be explained, for example? And there are tables in the report. here's where the Secretary of the Air Force made his classic statement. We believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers were overflown in the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been explained as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been obtained. That's the Secretary of the Air Force. That press release appeared all across the country. Now, it didn't give the title for the report. Surely if they had said Blue Book Special Report 14, the press would have said, hey, what happened to 1 through 13? We've never heard anything about them. The correct answer, had it been given, was that they were all classified. They weren't about to say that. Were the unknowns 3%? No, they were 21.5%. Now, that's not a round-off of 3. 3 isn't almost 21.5, you know. It's not even close. There's the categorization. And notice the next to the last claim, insufficient information. They go out of their way to stress. If there was vital information missing from a case, it could not be listed as an unknown. It had to be listed as insufficient information. So the Secretary of the Air Force saying that even the unknowns could have been explained if more complete observational data had been available is simply a lie. I don't like being lied to. What really got me into the business of serious investigation of UFOs was finding this report at the University of California, Berkeley, after having read roughly a dozen books, none of which mentioned it, so it came as quite a shock to me, and then being lied to by the Secretary of the Air Force. Taint right. And you'll notice there the psychological cases. The American Physical Society, to which I and most physicists belong, says that 2% of the papers submitted to them by their physicist members are crackpot papers. That means there's more crackpots associated with physics than with flying saucers. I'm one of the few with a foot in each camp, you understand. But here's the quality evaluation that I mentioned earlier. Now, notice, the better the quality, the more likely to be an unknown, which is what you'd expect if they were carefully examining these cases. If it's a poor quality report, it's not likely to be an unknown. It's likely to be almost anything else. You notice that last column, insufficient information. The excellent cases, only 3.9% had insufficient information. For the poor cases, 19.6%. So this was a careful, well-done study. That doesn't mean they didn't lie about it. Look, when I was in industry, I read lots of reports, and when I did a weekly science commentary for CBC Radio in Fredericton, New Brunswick for 6 years, I'd always find papers where the upfront conclusions often were contradicted by the data in the back of the report. But those upfront conclusions were intended for management. Nobody bothers to check. And I had some egregious examples that I found, the medical stories and stuff like that. When you go back and look at the data, you find it isn't what they claimed it was up front. So I mention this study because it should be mentioned by anybody who makes crazy claims about the data. Crazy meaning unsubstantiated claims. On the left, the UFO evidence. This was put out by the old National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP. Major Donald Kehoe, some of you may have read his books years ago. And in the UFO evidence, 18% of the 4,500 cases investigated could not be explained. 18%! On the right, that congressional hearings document, Symposium on Unidentified Flying Objects, hearings before the House Committee on Aeronautics and Astronautics. I was one of the 12 participants. I gave written testimony, as did 5 others, and 6 gave in-person testimony. Of course, the noisy negativists never talk about this study. I mentioned there was an astronomer who said only kooks see UFOs. 3 of the participants were astronomers. He, of course, doesn't reference the report. I mean, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up, you know. That's the idea here. The Condon report, as I mentioned, 30% of the cases they looked at couldn't be explained. Alan Hynek, an astronomer, you'd think he'd be the first point of reference for an astronomer saying only kooks see UFOs. But he's not even mentioned. He was chairman of the astronomy department at Northwestern University, Air Force scientific consultant of Project Blue Book for 20 years. Who would be more qualified to get an opinion from, especially when he's written a book? But, of course, we're not going to mention him. Now, the propulsion system. I've got some rare pictures. At least you won't see them everywhere. This is an early model of a possible nuclear-powered airplane. If you look down below, you'll see the two engines on the left bottom of this thing. They were in a water-cooled reactor that heated the air, which went through the turbine, which went through the engines. And this thing is all mounted on a railroad car because it gets quite radioactive after you've operated a bit. So you want to handle it remotely. You don't want to have a bunch of guys running around pushing on the thing. That was about 1956. That's what a flight-type system would look like. The reactor would be roughly 5 feet in diameter in the middle there. Those are big engines. I remember going up to see them at GE when I was working there, and big enough to walk in the inlet when the normal engine used at that time was half that size. Now, what's the benefit of a nuclear-powered airplane? Well, it can operate for thousands of hours without refueling. You change the crew, but you don't have to refuel. And so unlimited range, this was height of the Cold War. The only problem is GE had no guts because they didn't have any stake in the program. It was a cost-plus contract. They owned the rug on the boss's floor, the government facility. And that was it. Program got canceled, so what's the big deal? And there was no leadership. In contrast with the nuclear Navy, some of you may remember the name of Admiral Hyman Rickover. He was a damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead kind of guy. You don't want to go where we're going, get off the train. And that's why we have nuclear submarines and nuclear-powered carriers, and they've had some cruisers and other things. The difference it makes is when you're nuclear power, you can go full speed ahead and keep going and keep going and keep going. With a regular ship, you can't do that, or a regular airplane, you can't do that. You got to refuel. And that can be difficult in wartime. Kind of a neat system. There were several different programs. Pratt Whitney had a project, too. Theirs was a liquid metal-cooled reactor. A little problem with a liquid metal-to-air heat exchanger, incidentally. The exhaust temperature of the air was running about 1,800 degrees. With the submarine, the exhaust temperature of the water was about 1,000 degrees. And when you get up to 1,800, it's tough on materials. There's a nuclear-powered ramjet. The idea of this, of course, Link Temco bought, was to carry it up by a B-52, have it loaded with nuclear bombs, and release it, and it would fly any place in the planet to drop the bombs. And that got built. That program got canceled, too, of course. But they did operate one of these things on the ground. Here's a layout of several nuclear-powered rocket systems. There's a man in the middle there to get some idea of the size. Different power levels, different thrust levels. This is a 1968. Yeah, that's about right. The idea is you take liquid hydrogen, very cold, you pump it through the reactor and out through the nozzle, and it comes out at about 4,400 degrees. Very high thrust because there's no oxygen coming out. Normal chemical rockets, hydrogen and oxygen, hydrogen and kerosene, other things. These are heavy. Hydrogen's light. And the nice thing, too, is hydrogen is the most abundant substance in the most abundant element in the universe. Wherever you go, you're going to find hydrogen. Part of the ocean, of course, is made of hydrogen, H2O, you know, hydrocarbons. These were fun to work on. Now, you don't want to be next to them when they're operating. Very hot, radioactive. There is the NRX-A6. I worked on that for Westinghouse. reactors in the middle, nozzle upward firing. These were tested out near Area 51 at the nuclear test site, about 75 miles outside of Las Vegas, not in the middle of nowhere. And it really is in the middle of nowhere. There's a good reason if you're operating nuclear-powered systems. You really don't want many people, even jackrabbits, around. Not healthy for the system. Here's another one. This is one of Los Alamos's. Again, on a remote carrier. Here's what it looks like out there. Area 51's on the other side of those mountains. And that is a plume from one of these things. The tanks are liquid hydrogen. You're limited how long it can operate for how much you can store, because once you've operated for a while, it gets radioactive, becomes temperature hot, and you better have enough coolant to keep it cooled down. And there were people who said you can never operate a rocket with hydrogen. It's too dangerous, which reminds me of the cities that passed ordinance about storing gasoline for cars back at the turn of the 20th century. And most cities do have gasoline stored for their cars, of course, because we learn how to handle this stuff. I mentioned fusion earlier. These are the same equations. The point is, you've moved up the ladder of universal communities once you figured out what makes the stars work. It took us a while. Not surprising, for goodness sakes. Didn't know about neutrons till 1931. Didn't know about fusion until 1938. Our first nuclear chain reaction was 1942 at the University of Chicago, under the stands at the squash courts at the University of Chicago. It wasn't that long ago, in other words, that we were moving toward joining the community of nations, at least by knowing what produces the energy in the stars. That's a big step, a very big step. There were people who said the sun could only be 30 million years old because it wasn't enough fuel to fuel it for longer than that, because they were talking about chemical reactions. It doesn't use chemical reactions. It uses nuclear fusion. And, you can't complain about somebody who in 1900 didn't know about this. But in the year 2000, you'd think they'd be smart enough, if they're scientists, to be aware of this. The data's all over the place. So helium and deuterium is heavy water, heavy hydrogen. Normal hydrogen has got a proton in the middle and an electron on the outside. Deuterium, you add a neutron in the middle. Makes it twice as heavy, and its nuclear properties are a little different. And it's fundamental to the production of energy in the universe. We didn't discover until 1932. So the point here is, you think that maybe somebody out there got started a little bit before we did. They're going to know some things that we don't know, and when they learned what we have finally learned, it was probably a long time ago. That's the way things are. And if somebody's coming here, we know they discovered some secrets we don't have. And the point, as I mentioned earlier, was a lot of energy and charged particles, which you can direct out the rocket that way. And incidentally, it only takes 1 year at 1G to get to the speed of light. And you say, well, wait a minute now. Einstein said as you get close to the speed of light, time slows down for things moving that fast. Now, don't ask me why. That's the way the universe is created, according to Albert. And he turned out his ideas have stood up extremely well for a very long time. But what that means is, if you can go 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 37 light years in 6 months, pilot time. You go out, come back, marry your granddaughter's best friend. It's kind of a neat system. And you say, well, that's just theoretical. No, it isn't. When we design accelerators, we have to take this into account. When cosmic rays come in, and they were a great surprise when somebody discovered them. It's kind of interesting. The guy was measuring radioactivity coming from the ground. We didn't find out about radioactivity until about 1900. So he's making measurements as a function of height from the ground. And amazingly, the values went up as he went up. Well, they should have gone down. Come on. The ground's down here. You're up here. The further away you get, the less the radiation levels are. That's how he discovered cosmic rays. He made measurements from higher altitudes. There was stuff coming in from outside that we didn't even know was there. And having an influence on the clouds, it's a whole long story. But there are cosmic rays, even though we didn't know about them. You see, the idea is if we don't know about it, it doesn't exist, which is nonsense. It's not science. That's bias, prejudice, ignorance, you know, that sort of stuff. So when I talk about fusion being your entrance into the universal community of advanced nations, I don't mean there isn't something beyond that. I just mean that's good enough to get us where we want to go. And every darn scientist should know this. There's the question, isn't it? Never mind the saucer. Just see the guys who were driving. Does a nuclear physicist believe in little green men? Well, they're not green. They usually are little. And yes, there are plenty of reports of small beings associated with landed saucers. There are many physical trace cases. You never hear anybody talking about this. No physical evidence. It's all eyewitness testimony. I don't think radar reports are eyewitness testimony. You can record them on from the screen, you know, stuff like that. Physical trace cases like this, this is Delphos, Kansas. Ted Phillips of Missouri has collected more than 4,000 such cases. When you see the saucer sitting on or near the ground, and after it leaves, one finds physical changes. The equivalent of burn circles, burn rings, landing gear marks. Not crop circles. This one is Delphos, Kansas. I've been there. The soil down 14 inches in that 10-foot diameter ring was different in color and texture from the soil nearby. And it wouldn't grow anything. We have lots of such cases. There was a witness. The dirt on the left is normal dirt. The dirt on the right was from the affected ring. And don't get mad at me for using a paper plate. That's a sophisticated soil retention device, please. When I was at the University of Chicago, there was a Nobel Prize-winning physics experiment where they use an empty coffee can to hold up an important piece of equipment. If they can use a coffee can, I can use a paper plate. The famous Betty and Barney Hill story, as I mentioned earlier, the star map that tells us where those guys probably originate. There's Marjorie Fish, who did the work on the star map. She's also a sculptress who made that statue, if you will. You can see this was taken a long time ago. Look at the color of my beard. Early 70s. That's one of her models. Incredible amount of effort to put the beads in the right place. It only takes two angles to specify where to aim a telescope to see a particular star. Because the astronomers aren't going anywhere. What difference does it make whether it's 20 light years away or 40 light years? But if you're trying to look at a three-dimensional model and see if you can find a pattern that matches a two-dimensional pattern, you better get the distances right. And so she gradually got rid of stars and finally found one pattern that matched angle for angle, line length for line length, what Betty had drawn. It was a happy day. The star in the upper right there, I don't know if you can see them. Oh, there it is. Up there. That's the sun. It's kind of nice that the sun is in the pattern since they're coming here. And all the stars in the pattern are sun-like stars, and they're all in a plane. Think of slices of pepperoni on a big flat pizza, as opposed to raisins in a big fat loaf of raisin bread in all directions. What difference does it make? It's much easier to get to other stars if they're in the same plane, which is kind of nifty, in other words, for travel. So, exciting piece of work. And, yeah, all the numbers changed slightly because we finally got a good satellite up there. The Europeans did, European Space Agency. The Hipparchos satellite measured the distances to hundreds of thousands of stars accurately, they did. And that's kind of neat. Doesn't really change the results. A monument to persistence and care. She was a member of Mensa, brilliant woman. Those are the names of the stars. Gliese is the name of the best catalog at that time. The distances have all changed slightly. And the base stars down at the bottom, Zeta 1 Reticuli and Zeta 2 Reticuli. And those other numbers, LY means light years. And they're all changed slightly, but it doesn't change the net results. This is based on Betty doing a drawing under the direction from the psychiatrist, Ben Simon, who did the hypnosis session, with the caveat if she could remember it accurately. I wrote the first article on it in the infamous Saga magazine. And then I suggested to Terry Dickinson, editor of Astronomy magazine, that he do an article, and he did. He talked to a bunch of people, published an article, then he had letters over the next year, about 10 different letters, and he put out this 32-page full-color booklet. They sold 10,000 copies almost immediately, which is almost unheard of for this kind of thing. And then Carl Sagan's lawyer threatened to sue them because his name was on the front where it belongs, because he's one of the people who submitted a letter. And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, so I wound up buying 18,000 copies of the Zeta Reticuli incident. And I'd sell you one, except I'm out of the darn things long ago. A lot of interest in them. It's a wonderful piece of work, if for no other reason than it shows that a persistent amateur. And in my movie UFOs Are Real, we have the head of the astronomy department of Ohio State University saying how accurate her work was. Dr. David Saunders was there with J. Allen Hynek when I introduced them to her, and she made a presentation about the work she was doing. David was very impressed, as was Allen. That's the bust she did. Your typical little gray man, if you want. Your typical Zeta Reticulan, whatever you want to call them. There's a book by Kathleen Martin and myself. And if you're wondering, so why is my name first? It's because the publisher insisted. It'll sell more, he says. Now, there's no way you can turn down a publisher who says if we do it this way, it'll sell more than if we do it that way. So we had my name be first. It's done pretty well, and it's been optioned for a movie as well. And you may remember a television movie with James Earl Jones playing Barney. There's been a lot of work done on this since, of course. I was a technical advisor on that film, and what's ironical is that the Universal Studios got my name from the Air Force. I was living in the Los Angeles area, and they were supposed to, when the Air Force got asked about UFOs, oh, refer him to a scientist. I was the local scientist on UFOs, I guess. It was kind of fun. And James Earl Jones, I don't know how many of you saw that movie, The UFO Incident with James Earl Jones. What an actor. What an actor. And it wasn't 100% accurate, but it was damn good. And if you get close to accurate, you're doing pretty well with Hollywood. Any Hollywood representatives here? Forget I said that.